Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. We're just a couple months away from kids heading back to college, and Mark Hoffer is a certified educational planner. Generally speaking, are high schools preparing kids for what they're going to face at the college level?
It's an interesting question. You can look at things that are academic, and you can look at things that are social or psychological. And one of the things that I think has changed dramatically in the last couple of years is parents who have children who are headed to college, they entered college at a very different time, and they have this ideal of what college was like and what is required to be successful. That has changed. One of the main things that students are facing now are a different set of challenges socially, not only social media and all that, but also the academics are different in that the pressures, because of the financial pressures associated with college, are so high that we have students who basically are feeling so much of this pressure to perform, and they're supposed to know what they're going to do for the rest of their life, when we know that most people who graduate never work in the field that they actually studied.
And not to have you unjustify your job, but why have we made it so difficult for high school kids to get into college, which, in my opinion, these days, the four-year degree is about as equivalent as the high school diploma a few decades ago. It's absolutely necessary.
Yeah, and Colleen, you're right. It's actually worse than that, in that now a master's degree is the new bachelor's.
Okay, well then I'm behind, see?
and it's actually, I think it's actually sad because of the pressures that are on young people today to perform academically, know what they're supposed to be doing, and they don't.
How did it come to this?
That's a real good question. And I think a lot of it is trying to keep up with the Joneses. A lot of it is trying to assimilate all the information that students basically are surrounded by daily. With social media, you can't get away from it. And basically, they have this pressure to perform at certain levels that are actually, you know, they're not within reach.
So now that we're entering the time where admissions have been handed out, kids are going to the college of whatever one they were accepted to, what is the advice you're passing on to these kids now? Because it doesn't end after they're accepted to a college. They have to maintain a certain lifestyle over the summer before they head to college.
For sure. Well, one of the things I like working with students as early as possible, is freshman, sophomore. I develop a lot of skills that are basically based on character development and you know, social graces. And those are the things that actually set you up for doing well academically, which sets you up well for doing the college admissions and applications process. If you don't do those things early, and many parents, they focus on the academics and setting their children up to do well and be successful academically. But what they forget are some of the social components of that, of being a good person, being nice. Actually, colleges have a section of the application evaluation that's called niceness, and it covers, it sounds like it's squishy, but it's everything from maturity and the social graces. Do you know how to say thank you? Do you know how to say please? And holding the door for somebody when they are behind you.
Well, how do they prove that, though? A kid could say, yeah, I hold the door for somebody.
It's interesting. You can, in an application, and I've read, you know, thousands of applications, and people who do admissions, they honestly, if they've been doing it for a number of years, they have seen so many variations of applications that they actually read between the lines, and they can interpret what's not being said and what's being said, you know, on the page.
And social media?
No.
They check that?
Is social media checked?
Are they checking social media?
Oh, boy. You know, and this is actually one of those hidden little secrets that people who do the work that I do, if you ask them, they will tell you what they're looking for and how they look for it. And one of the things is social media. Not only do they check social media, like your digital footprint. So basically, if a student has their social media digital footprint out there, colleges actually look at it during the application process, not just once, but multiple times. Mm. And in the last couple of years, we've heard situations where not only do they look at it during the application process, but let's say you have a student who's been accepted to multiple universities, And then they get on to social media and they slam colleges that they got into, but they aren't going to.
Mm.
And colleges are looking at that and rescinding offers. Mm. And wow. That is a pretty frightening thing.
Mark Hoffer is a certified educational planner. Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave.
Choke Points, brought to you by Online Training Academy. Well, this would be the perfect jungle gym for the backyard if you have a lot of kids. A 371-foot-long historic steel truss bridge, only slightly used, and they'll help you take it away. Chris, what's the deal here?
Well, this is the 93-year-old Meridian Street Bridge that's been sitting along Highway 167 in Puyallup for nearly 3 years since it was removed in one piece and set down on state land just north of the river. The plan was for King or Pierce County to take this bridge from the state, restore it a bit, and reuse it in some way, like as a walking bridge on a trail or maybe an attraction at a park. But the counties didn't want it, and now the Department of Transportation has to make it available to the public. Starting today, you can submit proposals to take the 379-ton bridge span off the state's hands.
Because of its historic nature, we are moving forward with trying to find an owner that would take ownership of it and preserve it for the future.
Steve Fox is the project manager for the 167 Gateway Project. Getting rid of the bridge falls under his jurisdiction, especially because the bridge's span is now sitting in his right-of-way for that project. He needs to get rid of it. But here's the deal. The state's going to pay you to take it.
We're actually offering up the cost of demolition to the new owner, which is up to a maximum of $1 million. So it's not actually that they'll actually be paying us. We will be paying the new owner the cost, the estimated cost of demolition.
So a bridge and $1 million. Now, when Fox speaks of demolition, he isn't talking about taking the bridge apart. He's talking about scrapping it. He's talking about, you know, maybe taking it apart and then putting it back together, because you can't sell the steel for scrap. Part of the deal is you've got to keep the bridge intact, or at least most of it intact. It's historic.
Either moving the bridge intact, which is not an easy thing to do, or disassembling the bridge and moving it to a new location and reassembling it. And then, of course, there would be costs in the future for preserving the bridge.
So bidders will get more points if they plan to keep the entire bridge intact or if they plan to keep it for a longer period of time. Fox is hopeful that someone in the Puyallup area will get it.
I think in a perfect world, because of the context, it would reside right there in the Puyallup River Valley, and would be in a place where the public would have access to it.
Again, the winning proposal will have to move the bridge, but the state will pay up to $1 million for that.
We're kind of excited to see how the process goes and see what kind of ideas people have for repurposing this bridge.
And if you're wondering why the state is paying somebody to take the bridge instead of selling it, well, that comes down to federal regulations. Since this is designated as a historic bridge, that's the way the federal guidelines are set up. So that's the way it works. And again, this answers the question. This came up during a Choke Point segment a couple months ago. You asked me, whatever happened to that thing?
Yeah.
Well, it's still sitting there. The county's kind of screwed the state over because they were expected to take it.
Suppose
now it's up
takes
to the
it
public.
Even with the subsidy. Can they redesignate it as just a rusty bridge?
Well,
we'll
cross that bridge when they get to it. No point
Perfect
taken.
Power out.
So we'll have to wait and see if anybody wants it. But goes out for proposal today. You can start today.
I hold in my hand the executive order, which says it is the policy of this administration to maintain family unity, including by detaining alien families together where appropriate and consistent with law and available resources. And Hannah Scott is here to tell us that there are some local officials who do not think that goes far enough.
Absolutely, Dave. So from state and local leaders to the hundreds of faith leaders and concerned citizens who packed a Seattle church yesterday to get an update on the situation at the border where families were being separated, the reaction to President Trump's executive order reversing the policy of separating families at the border was the same, that it was nowhere near good enough.
That's the bare minimum for us not to be a terrorist kind of organization.
That's Reverend Nancy Ross with St. Mark's Episcopal Cathedral. And she says, while the president's order temporarily stops the separation of families, it maintains that zero tolerance policy.
That is a drop in the bucket. All that does is stop something heinous that has recently been begun. But heinous things were already happening. And people who are not being respected to find out if their asylum is going to be here. People who are detained without speaking to anyone about their rights. People who don't know where their family members have been taken for days and days on end. This has been going on long before we got the hot button issue this past week about the families being separated.
Now, Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkan, who is at the U.S.-Mexico border in Texas today, she also slammed the president for creating a humanitarian crisis that can't be fixed with what she called a hollow executive order that does nothing to reunite the 2,300 children already taken away from their families at the border who are now already being placed in foster care in group homes. We expect the mayor to speak in about 45 minutes from the Texas border, and we'll bring you more of that when I talk to you again in the 8 o'clock hour. Now, even before the president's executive order, Governor Inslee had planned to announce that he was giving $1.2 million to the Northwest Immigrants' Rights Project's legal aid fund to help those families separated at the border, including hundreds being held here in our state. He went ahead with that plan even after hearing that the president's order was coming.
These funds will be used to defend the rights of immigrants and to help children and parents navigate this complex maze in order to reunite their families, as it should be. Many of whom who are the victims, of the gang violence that we hear so much about from the White House. The president's actions today do not change this. We have more than 2,300 children separated from their parents today. The damage has been done.
As for the order the president signed, Inslee said,
should we be confident in an administration that is morally bankrupt, that is a White House that is full of a den of deceit, that lied about what they did to this children, lied about why they did this to this children, and lied about who is responsible for what they did to this children, and lied about what it would take to fix it? And the answer is no. We cannot and should not be confident of the person in the White House who, as of yesterday, was lying about this situation.
And Senator Patty Murray also criticized Trump's reversal from the Senate floor yesterday.
President Trump says the executive order stops the separation. Does that mean starting today? Next month? When? What about the thousands of children who've been removed? Will they ever see their parents again? When? Where? How?
Now, as for Mayor Durkan, who went down to Texas, why go down to Texas? There's a detention center with some of these children at SeaTac, right?
Well, and it's not a solo trip that she's doing on her own. This is a collective group of, I want to say, 20 or so mayors from across cities across the country who feel quite strongly about this. They're going to get a firsthand look. I don't know why you don't go here. I think because that's right. I believe she's right at the U.S.-Mexico border, so you wouldn't be able to have that kind of an aspect right here. She's maybe getting a closer look at what's happening at those border crossings, as well as detention centers that are there, and finding out more from Border Patrol and what else she can find out in that particular area. We do know that she'll give us an update here in about, like I said, 45 minutes, so we'll see what she's learned and what she has to say.
What surprised me was that from what the Associated Press is reporting, some of the people being held at the SeaTac Detention Center, the parents, one in particular has a child who was taken to New York State, like 2,100 miles away, and because she has no money, wasn't even allowed to make a phone call to her kid, which seemed to me to be a little bit unreasonable. I mean, if you're picked up for murder, they give you a phone call.
Everybody gets a phone call, right? That's due process. It's part of what your rights are. But I don't know what your rights are when you're detained as an elite. Someone who's crossed the border illegally. I don't know if you get those same rights.
I take it that we're sticking with our sanctuary city position?
Welcoming city. I think we call ourselves a welcoming city.
Welcoming
now, but
city.
Yes, that's the case. The big highlight here is from the critics of this plan is not separating these families. 2,300 kids are separated already because of this policy from their families. Nine of them, by the way, have been confirmed to be in this state. Nine children being held in this state. But there's really no, even as you read that executive order, we're going to stop that separation of families. But there's not a lot of solid directive as to what we're going to do about those 2,300 kids already separated. How are they going to get back with their families? Are they going to?
Yeah. Well, CBS reported this morning that, in fact, that's considered to be already set in stone. So anybody's already been separated, the old rule still applies to them. This is just about anybody else who hasn't been handled yet.
Yeah, so it's moving forward. And again, even then, there's temporary because it's only for 20 days. The big thing here that needs to happen is that the zero tolerance policy needs to be addressed somehow by Congress. The football punted back to Congress by the president, of course, yesterday.
Hannah Scott, thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Time for our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealer. The Mariners skipper wants to see Ichiro in this year's Home Run Derby at the All-Star Game in D.C. There is now a campaign to make that happen called hashtag Ichi4DC. And here's what the coach told the MLB Network.
You know, a lot of today's players don't want to get the home run hitting contest. I think Ichiro would be a great addition home run hitting contest at the All-Star Game, because he takes BP every day and he is launching balls. It's really fun to watch.
Yeah, well,
I think that would draw a lot of fan interest.
So, Danny, who picks those the people who are eligible to hit in the Derby?
Well, they invite guys. I'm sure that there's a committee, or ultimately it's the commissioner's office that I'm sure he has people that help him select that. But they invite guys, and then the guy has to accept the invitation. I'm not sure about the rules about retired players, but then Ichiro's not technically retired.
Right.
He's just not on the active roster. I'd love to see it. The only fear I have is that he might actually win the thing, and then it will revive the single most annoying Seattle fan debate, which was there are people who believe Ichiro could hit home runs pretty much anytime he wanted to, but chose not to because he wanted to focus on getting singles, which is maybe the most infuriating of all the opinions I've ever heard about Seattle sports.
I had not heard that. Would it also put him back on the team if he was able to knock a few homers out there?
Well, he's not going to be on the team this year. They've kind of spelled that out and said that. I think that all signs point to him being on the team when they open the season next year in Japan. You get an extra roster spot. So I think that, I don't know if I would say expect it, but I certainly am projecting that or saying that, hey, I wouldn't be surprised at all if he is there. But he's not going to play on the team this year. It would be more of a show for fun. I'd love to see it.
So on the team just for the first game in Japan, or the first series in Japan?
There's two games in Japan, yes. And for those games, you get an extra roster spot.
Uh-huh.
You get 26 players on the active roster. And DePoto, even at the time that they announced that he wouldn't be playing again this season, left open that possibility and said he wouldn't be surprised. So I don't know if there's a handshake agreement that he will be, but I think that all the signs point toward that being, if not likely, very possible.
Hmm. So the Yankee game yesterday, Mariners had a 5-0 lead. So do the Yankees just sort of, play with you like a cat plays with a dead mouse? Is that what they do?
The Yankees have a ton of power, and the Mariners unfortunately had two relievers who left pitches up and out against players you cannot do that with. One resulted in a game-tying home run. That was Alex Colome that gave that up in the eighth inning, and that was the huge blow because at that point the 5-run lead was completely gone. It was 5-5, and you going into the Yankees bullpen, which is one of the strengths of its team, and Aroldis Chapman pitched the top of the ninth, and then Scott Servais had a bit of a choice. You don't pitch your closer in that situation because you still want to save him in case you do get a lead to slam the door shut. Ryan Cook, who had warmed up previously in the game, came in and he made a mistake. It was an 0-2 pitch. It should have been nowhere near the strike zone, and he left it. It's a slider that was over the plate, and Giancarlo Stanton crushed it, and there was no doubt about it, and it was really disappointing. Now it's just one game and one series, and you don't want that to undo all of the momentum that's built up. But the idea, the difference between going for a series victory today with James Paxton on the mound and trying to avoid the sweep is pretty significant. And they had a 5-run lead, and Felix pitched well. They should have won that game.
They should have. Yeah, I was going to ask, are they playing the way they have been, or was this just a rough game?
They gave up a lot of home runs, and that's been the case. The Yankees are one of the best home run hitting teams in history, not just in the league right now. They clobber home runs. They strike out a ton. They have a lot of power pitchers coming out of their bullpen. They've got a pretty established formula. They have the best home winning record in the league. I think we're seeing a little bit why. But the Mariners should have won that game last night, and they didn't because their bullpen faltered, and that's disappointing.
Well, plus, as we discussed yesterday, Yankee Stadium is rigged.
Well, the old Yankee Stadium was more rigged. It's more just that they've somehow found a way to get two enormous giants on the same team in Aaron Judge and Giancarlo Stanton. And they make the Mariners look Lilliputian by comparison, Dave.
Our Sports Insider is brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you tomorrow.
There is a story behind every one of those migrants we've been talking about as part of this refugee crisis. Gene Johnson of the Associated Press talked with one of them. Blanca Orantes Lopez is being held at the Federal Detention Center in SeaTac.
She's a Salvadoran woman She says that her family received a threat in mid-April demanding $5,000 or people would kidnap or kill her 8-year-old son. And she and the boy's father decided to pack up and head toward the United States.
You talked to her from the detention center. Did she know what was going on at the border at the time she decided to leave?
No, it doesn't seem like she did. She thought that she would be able to apply for asylum when she got here. She thought that she would be able to join her sister who lives in Maryland. She told me that she wanted to work, raise her kid, be a good person, and just basically said, I thought it would be different.
Yeah. So she came north with her 8-year-old boy, Abel. At what point were they separated?
So they reached the border. It took them about a month to get there in South Texas. And they crossed illegally with a group of about 20 other people. They encountered Border Patrol. Her attorney says she reported herself to the Border Patrol, and that she was quickly separated from her son so that she could be prosecuted for the misdemeanor of illegal entry. She was taken to kind of a series of detention facilities. At one point, the guards brought her son to her, and they told her, say goodbye to him because he's being transferred. She asked where. They just told her again to say goodbye, and that he started crying, saying, don't leave me, Mom. She said she didn't know what else to say to him except to tell him that it will be okay, to try to reassure him. And that was the last time that she spoke to him. It's been about a month. He has been transferred to a sort of a foster care home in upstate New York, and she was transferred to the Federal Detention Center at SeaTac.
Wow. That's about as separate as you can make two people and still be in the continental United States. For the people who show up at the border claiming asylum, the Secretary of Homeland Security said that nobody is turned away. No, she's saying that's the right way to do it. Show up and tell your story. But at the same time, what they're actually finding when they get there is that there's no place to sit even because there's so many people, right?
Right, exactly. And that's what her attorney, Matt Adams, at the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project told me. He said there are many people who are showing up at the border intending to apply for asylum at a port of entry, and they're being told that there's no capacity to handle them. And so he says their options are basically to try to hang out and wait in Mexico or to try to enter the U.S. illegally and then apply for asylum once they enter the country, which they are allowed to do under federal law.
Well, it's I can see why she's miserable. On the other hand, I can hear people saying, well, the alternative was to stay in El Salvador and maybe lose her son forever. Does she consider this better than that, I guess is the question.
Certainly, I would think anyone would think it's better than having your child kidnapped or killed by criminal gangs, certainly. That said, she certainly would prefer to be with him.
Can she at least call her son?
For most of the time that she has been in custody over the past month, she hasn't even known where he is. It wasn't until about a week and a half ago that she was handed a slip of paper with the phone number for this facility in Kingston, New York, and she was told that's where her son is. But her attorney says she hasn't been able to call because she has no money and she hasn't been able to place a collect call, that the prison at SeaTac won't facilitate her making a free call to talk to her son. That said, her son has been able to call his aunt. Her name is Maria Arantes. And Maria told one of my colleagues that the boy is always crying when he calls her, that he really, really doesn't feel well there and that he doesn't want to be there.
Associated Press reporter Gene Johnson.